Welcome back to the Wealth Actually podcast, the show that features artists, entrepreneurs, experts, and commentators that will give you the right knowledge, planning, and guidance so you can preserve your assets and enjoy your wealth. Learn more and subscribe today at wealthactually.com. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes. It is neither investment, legal, nor tax advice and does not represent the opinions of the employers of the host or guest. And now, here's your host, Fraser Rice.
Welcome back to the Wealth Actually podcast. I'm Fraser Rice. We're going to talk a little bit about something. Actually, each of these topics probably deserves their own podcast, but it's the intersection of AI and the healthcare industry. It's something that I think has gone sort of woefully unlooked at by a lot of folks, and certainly the financial services world. And there are a lot of clients that have to deal with that on a day-to-day basis, as far as understanding how their healthcare is impacted, but then also how their financial situations are impacted. We're going to have on the podcast with us is Chris High, who is a longtime fan of the show and is now making his second appearance, which is always nice to see. Chris, how are you?
I'm great, Fraser. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to our conversation today.
Since we don't want people to have to go back into the Wayback Machine to see your last appearance, can you give us an update on what you're up to and what your company does?
Sure. And there have been some updates. So I name my company's Wealthcare Solutions. I have two companies, Wealthcare Solutions and Wealthcare Planning. And our goal is really to help mostly financial planners and the clients they work with better plan for health and longevity related financial risks. And I think it's an area that, especially as the population in the U.S. ages, it's an area that financial professionals need to focus on more. Because when you think about it, and even when you ask older adults what they feel the biggest threat to their financial security is, they almost never say inflation. They almost never say taxes. But they'll often say a health event. Almost always say health event, high healthcare costs, outliving my savings. These consistently show up in surveys as the areas of greatest concern as you get older. So I think it's something, again, as the population ages, that financial professionals need to spend more time addressing these concerns. And I'm trying to help them more effectively identify clients who need this kind of help and be able to deliver that help.
It's one of these things. I see lots of different charts and articles on it that show that spending goes down for a person, even toward the end of life, when counterintuitively, I guess, the medical bills, in my opinion, increase significantly. And I tell people all the time, if you don't think wealth redistribution is alive and well in this country, take a look at what happens when you have to pay for senior care living and those types of things. And you start looking at what it costs a month to go from one type of healthcare to another type. And if you go to assisted living to full board nursing care, you're talking about another college tuition or two. And if you have lots of different people that you have to support, that it's a big number. And I can't understand how that works with the different research that's out there. There's something about it that I'm just not seeing. What has your experience been on that front?
My mother had dementia. And she was in a memory unit, and we were paying, it was over, I think, $10,000 a month. So that's, you know, two good, you know, Ivy League college tuitions on an annual basis. I have friends with older parents who were literally spending $20,000 or $30,000 a month, you know, all in. And the mom wants to stay at home. Great. Okay. So you need a landscaper, you need a house cleaner, you need a home health aide. I mean, unfortunately, it's often more expensive to stay at home. But yeah, these costs are, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 a month, and the average person needs about 3 years of long-term care. So if you do the math, it's, you know, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that's not even healthcare costs. You know, the healthcare costs long-term. I'm just talking about, you know, being able to afford the activities of daily living. But then, you know, people on top of that, you know, some of these drug treatments can cost thousands or tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, you get into that and you get into surgeries and therapy and other types of situations, and it balloons quickly. And it seems like a part of the world where inflation doesn't seem to have any governor on it, and these folks can charge whatever they want.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, I've been looking at some of this data, and you know, since 1960, you know, healthcare, the price index for healthcare services was lower than the overall price index, like for four of those years. And it was like during the years of the oil shocks in the 70s, basically, you know, costs have been coming down a little bit, but year after year after year, I think when you add it all up now, since the early 60s, healthcare costs have risen six times faster than inflation. Six times, that's a huge number.
No, that number is out of control, and it sort of aligns well with the sort of college education inflation as well, I think. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, artificial intelligence and sort of machine learning and other components of information parsing that has sort of been put out there as a panacea for a lot of things. And it's undoubtedly going to have a lot of impact on the healthcare system, late stage healthcare, et cetera. But help us get our arms around what that looks like. How is it changing medical research, for instance?
It's going to make massive changes. And full disclosure, even though I did graduate work at MIT in the 1990s, and I had a very small connection with some of the folks working on AI, I've been kind of an AI skeptic over the years. It's not that I didn't think that it was affecting me in positive ways, mostly. I just thought that the hype was a lot bigger than the reality. And that really started changing recently with these large language models. I've used them a lot over the last couple of years, and sure, there are limitations we could discuss, but it was a game changer. I think almost everybody, you know, involved with this research, there was some paper that came out in 2017, I won't get it, you know, that really advanced these large language models and these abilities to analyze these huge data sets and to interpret text. So I think now it's for real. I think AI is with us now. It's going to fundamentally change many aspects of our lives. And if you talk to most experts, many people think that the biggest impact, especially in the short term, is going to be on medical research. I mean, as you know, medical research is incredibly expensive. There's studies that showing that the cost of developing a drug is somewhere in the hundreds of millions, even upwards of $1 billion to develop a drug. Clinical trials consistently fail for all kinds of reasons, even for drugs that are good. You can screw up trials and a lot of things can go wrong. So one of the biggest advantages of AI technologies is already showing up in medical research. I mean, the human body is incredibly complex. We've got, 25,000 genes, and they create, we don't even know how many proteins, but it's, hundreds of thousands of proteins. And a lot of drugs are designed to modify or target specific proteins in our body. And the problem is, it's really hard to figure out, okay, I'm targeting this protein or these proteins. Well, what's sort of the spillover effect? How's that going to affect other proteins? You get a little bit of a whack-a-mole problem. I push down here, something unintended comes up over here, and all of a sudden we've got heart issues or we've got kidney issues that we couldn't anticipate. So what AI is going to enable us to do is to basically increase dramatically the probability of our clinical trials actually coming up with positive results. We're going to be able to narrow down the different approaches. We're going to be able to narrow down the targets and better understand. I guess it's just increasing the probability of success of trials. That's already starting to happen. So I think that is going to be one of the biggest areas. So that's going to lead to faster and cheaper drug development. I think that's almost. I don't think many, inarguable, I think almost everybody believes that. So that's going to be, again, something that's going to affect all of us and in a mostly very positive way.
So as it sort of locks into getting past research a little bit and changing healthcare as far as maybe determining actuarial tables with more specificity, maybe coming together with different types of treatments based on maybe digital markers or genetic markers or things like that, so the buildup of knowledge around different factors for treatment kicks in. Are these things that we can look forward to quickly, or is there, what am I missing on that as well?
No, some of this is already happening a little bit, and I'll go into detail. But yes, I think at a high level, the way I think about it is that AI is going to enable our healthcare to be much more personal. So we're going to be all these things about the biomarkers and understanding the genetics. I mean, there are already drugs out there that will cure you and kill me. Same drug. Or, you know, won't work at all for me, works great for you. And it has to do with our genetic makeup. So we're going to be able to get, again, much better at targeting and being able to figure out, okay, this drug's going to work for Frazier based on everything we know about his genetic structure, but it's not going to work so great for Chris, so we need to look at this other drug. So I think AI is going to really accelerate that trend. It's also just, there's going to be, and it's starting to, AI can be really good at analyzing really big data sets, right? And so where do you get really big data sets? And one area you get it is in medical research. I mean, you have these trials and these studies that have, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of data points. And so what AI is really good at doing, it's already been doing this for in Alzheimer's research, where there have been people who have taken these huge data sets and now can predict to a much greater extent who has Alzheimer's or who's more likely to develop Alzheimer's. It's still a little bit early, but I think for Alzheimer's, you know, it's hard for me to imagine now a cure of Alzheimer's that doesn't involve AI technologies.
I mean, as you get into the Alzheimer's discussion, it's a point of personal issue. I have a grandmother with it, and she was wonderful up to age 95. Sadly, she lived to be 102, and so it was a slow decline into the world of dementia there. Go into a little more depth, I think, on the AI area regarding dementia identification and then treatment. What's the reason for hope here?
There's at least two reasons. One is going to help us better identify. Three reasons, I guess. It's going to help us better identify people who have and predict people who are likely to have Alzheimer's. So we're going to be able to be a little more proactive. It's going to contribute to a cure, and similar to what I discussed before in general about medical research, applies maybe even stronger for Alzheimer's. It's gonna help us find the right targets, the right people to give the right drugs to. It's gonna help with that. And then it's going to help with just the day-to-day lives of people with Alzheimer's. And we're seeing this a little bit. I mean, one strong characteristic of these large language models is they can make really nice digital companions who can not only just help with basic information, but can be, you know, almost compassionate friends and support systems for older adults. So, you know, you think of kind of like Alexa or Siri on steroids. So there's going to be an element of older adults being able to have that socialization, you know, from a robot, but these robots are going to get pretty good at seeming like a real person. And then there's just other technologies that are going to just make it easier and perhaps more importantly, safer to live at home. I mean, the appliances are going to get smarter, you know, security systems are going to get smarter, cameras, in-home cameras are going to get smarter. And this is all going to help people take care of family members or other friends with dementia and keep those dementia patients, those Alzheimer's patients safer as long as they do live in their home.
So one of the things that pops up with this conversation all the time is the sort of the relinquishment of privacy and access to your data, maybe having your data going to people that at the really bad end, have bad designs on you. At the less bad end, but equally damaging sometimes, are people who make interpretations on the gaps in data or problems that you end up having that create bad advice or maybe hallucinations in the LLM model or something like that. How do you think about that in terms of sort of the overall deliverable to someone who could really use the assist?
One way to think about these AI models, a simple way to me, is they're software. You know, they're software and they have bugs, so they're not perfect. You know, I use ChatGPT and I ask it questions, and I like to say I get an answer. I don't necessarily get the answer, but I get an answer. So, but the but is that I think that's going to improve. The hallucinations are going to become more less frequent. I think they're going to do a better job of giving us more accurate information. So I'm longer term, I'm more optimistic. Sure, in the short term, might there be privacy issues, people doing bad things with your data? Yes. On the flip side, AI is going to help us do a better job. It's already doing, you know, a better job of fraud prevention. You look in banks, and you know they have these models now that are looking for unusual activity. I mean, I got a pop-up message 3 days ago saying, "Did you spend $500 at a Walmart in Ohio?" No. And it's funny because I've been traveling a bit. I was just in Hawaii, and it seemed fine that I was in Hawaii and I was in California, but it picked up this expense. And I don't go to Walmart much, and I certainly don't spend $500, so that was part of it. But you know, so that's the plus side, right? It may encourage some bad actors, but it's also going to help us do a better job of catching those bad actors.
One of the things we talked about before we got on was the widening gap between retirement and late stage healthcare, and then ultimately passing away. And a lot of ink's been spilt or pixels been deployed talking about late stage healthcare and the cost and what it looks like as you get closer to death. One of the things that I get concerned about is, let's call it, the HRification of work and the retirement age, and everyone, I think, sort of assumes that you'll be able to retire at 65, or if you can't, you'll be able to work longer. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think the world, the corporate world especially, is driving younger and younger and cheaper solutions so that it's not as easy to work to sort of maintain things. And so that gap, that retirement funding gap, is widening at both ends. And that's sort of maybe an AI problem at the younger end, and so that the gains that you get at the back end might be muted a little bit. Has that come across your research?
A little bit. And I've done a lot of thinking about that. I mean, one thing that unfortunately is ageism is one of the few remaining socially acceptable biases. I mean, you can't and you shouldn't make jokes about race and gender, but it's still okay to make jokes about older people, you know, or you know, to just say, "Oh, that person's, you know, incompetent because they're older." And I think as a society, we have a ways to go before we overcome that age bias, and it shows up, you know, starkly in many cases in the workplace. And I think, I'm a bit optimistic. I'm hoping that, and you see some signs of this, that especially larger employers are going to see the value in having older workers. I mean, studies consistently show, like, most older workers, not only do they have more experience, so, you know, they're more likely to come and say, okay, you know, you come into a meeting and they're more likely to be able to say, okay, I've seen this movie before, you know, this ain't going to work. Or I've seen, you know, we're trying to do X, Y, and Z, and three other companies I tried to do X, Y, and Z, and it never worked. That's just something a younger employee can maybe say they did that once, but they can't say that three times. So I think not only do they bring that experience, but there's also, and there's studies that suggested this, that there is this kind of emotional maturity that a lot of older adults have. So they're more likely to be the ones in the room and says, okay, don't freak out. You know, I understand you're upset. I understand, and you know, that you're stressed, but we need to, you know, take a more dispassionate look at this. And they can be much better at conflict resolution and just, you know, being the adult in the room, being the calming presence in the room. So I'm hopeful that, you know, companies are going to see that. I don't want to talk about it in detail because it hasn't come out yet, but I am talking to another person who's, you know, actively putting together a company it's kind of like a recruiter, a headhunter in effect, almost for older adults, exclusively for older employees. And you know, some of that may be part-time work, but I think you might see more of that in the future.
I was going to say, anything where, you know, more people in the room who have the experience of saying this too shall pass, it leads to, I think, generally better decisions, actually probably a better culture generally in a lot of workforces.
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, when we were growing up, you know, in tribes, you know, 10, 100,000 years ago, we grew up in tribes. You know, we were used to, there were multi-generations interacting with each other all the time. And I think that's something that we've kind of lost over the years. And, you know, we've become more isolated. And I think to the extent that we can go back and again, companies can create this environment to some degree, you know, have people of different ages interacting on a regular basis, I only think the outcomes will improve.
So take us through, before we check out here, what your company is up to and what your big initiatives are.
What I've been doing over the last year or so is I've been developing a new application. It's called WealthBot, Wealth with a WH. And what it's aimed to do is to help people more effectively plan for longevity. So, and it includes an AI model within it. So what I've been doing is training a model. So one thing that's really cool about these technologies like ChatGPT is they're now enabling individuals to go in and train the model. So what does that mean? So what I've done is I've taken the ChatGPT infrastructure, and I have a lot of content. So, you know, I've developed content over the years. I've got checklists, I've got a bunch of planning guides, I've got sample documents, all having to do with, again, mitigating these health and longevity related risks to financial security. Put those all in, sort of populated the model with that data. And so now users can go in and ask queries, again, very personal queries. You know, I have a mother with Alzheimer's. You know, what should I do? Or how can you help me with caregiving? Or how can you help me put together my legal documents? So there's a model in there that answers the questions. And then if the user wants to drill down, they can actually access those planning guides, those checklists. And then I also still have the behavioral assessments. The one behavioral assessment, the financial decision-making assessment I have that's based on the study that I worked on conducted at Mass General Hospital. So it's designed to be kind of a one-stop shop for longevity planning. Anybody could use it. There's a kind of a direct-to-consumer version. And then also I'm starting to talk with some companies about building out their own version of the model, which would use my data for training, but also use some of their data. You know, at a high level, this stuff's complicated. You know how complicated this is. You know, planning for a long life, I mean, it's different, especially in the United States. You know, we have this, you know, very complex mix of private and public institutions, and we have to go, you know, for this piece, we're talking to the government. For this piece, we're talking to our advisor. For this piece, we're talking to our lawyer. So what I'm trying to do is make it easier for people to do this and then ask questions and get a little education. And then they can say, okay, now this is what I need to talk to my advisor about. This is what I need to talk to my attorney about. But just providing that assistance, which I think a lot of people are really looking for, but don't know where to find it.
Really cool. Chris, thank you for being on. You're always welcome back. How do people find your firm and how do they kick the tires on what you're building?
If you go to wealthbot.com, so it's WHEALTHBOT.com, or you can go to wealthcareplan.com. That'll point you to WealthBot. But go ahead. I've put the trained model. It's right on the homepage of the website. You can use it for free. So just go in and ask a question, you know, ask a question about estate planning, ask a question about caregiving, ask a question about dementia. Again, it's not perfect, but I think check it out. And I'd be curious to get your feedback, but I think it's getting to the point where now it can provide pretty reliably and pretty accurate answers to questions about longevity.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a bewildering subject to have to deal with, and it's sad, it's wrapped up in emotion, and it's a very uncomfortable place to be. So anytime that you can sort of have technology helping you around that process, I think it's great. So I appreciate everything you're doing on that front, Chris.
Thanks again. Thanks for having me, and I really appreciate being on your show.
Thanks again for coming.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Wealth Actually, hosted by Fraser Rice, author of the book Wealth Actually and a leading private wealth manager. Head on over to wealthactually.com where you can subscribe to this podcast get your own copy of the Wealth Actually book, and connect with Fraser directly. We'll see you next time on Wealth Actually. Fraser Rice is an employee of Next Capital Management, LLC. This podcast is not investment, legal, or tax advice, nor does it reflect the opinions of Next Capital Management. Any opinions represented in the show are Fraser's individually and not an endorsement of the guest.